Hi, welcome to Alaska Radio Reader Rambler. I'm Sandy Harper here with my colleague Dick Reichman with your monthly literary snack and interview. And this week we have a special treat for you. Jim Barnett has written a very special book. You know, in Anchorage in Alaska, there's a Cook Avenue, there's the Captain Cook Hotel, there's Cook Inlet, of course, Cook Inlet Historical Society. And yet we don't know too much about Captain Cook's adventures in Alaska. And Jim Barnett, who happens to be the president of the Cook Inlet Historical Society as well, is going to tell us about his book and about Captain Cook and Alaska. So, Jim, tell us some more.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandy. Thank you, Dick.
I enjoyed
the opportunity to visit with you about one of my favorite subjects. Captain Cook, as we all know, came to Alaska. It was in 1778, now 230 years ago. It was at the time of the American Revolution, that far back. He was the first European in Cook Inlet, and he spent a summer here, essentially tracing the coast of Alaska. He started in Oregon and went all the way around the coast of Alaska to the Arctic ice pack near Barrow. And in the course of that was essentially the first European to fully understand the coastline of Alaska. He was a famous man. He was on his third voyage looking for the Northwest Passage. But interestingly, in all the hundreds of volumes that have been written about the fellow in the past, no one's really spent time talking about Alaska, what he did in Alaska, why he came to Alaska, the people he encountered in Alaska, and most important, the record that he left of Alaska, which is really quite fascinating.
He kept his own log. Is that how most of your information?
Yes,
there?
He kept his not only that, I've seen the log. It's at the British Library in London, and it's a pretty fascinating experience.
So he went from Sitka all around the coast, all the way up to Barrow, all around the west coast of Alaska and
exactly,
the southeast coast
exactly.
of Alaska?
He actually touched in Oregon. The Admiralty had asked him to find the Northwest Passage, which was an imagined thing that was going to take explorers from somewhere around, Juneau, back to Europe without having to fiddle around with, going around South America or Africa, the Horn of Africa. And so everyone was anticipating that it was just a guy like Cook who could find it. They often thought of it like Francis Drake when he entered the Pacific at Tierra del Fuego. You know, he went through this intricate passage called the Strait of Magellan, and then all of a sudden he opened up on the Pacific Ocean, and they were imagining the same thing would happen somewhere here in North America.
What courage these
Amazing.
Guys had.
Well, he didn't get stopped by the sea ice when he got up around the northern coast of Alaska?
Oh, yes, he did.
He did?
Yes. I mean, he was... in fact, he almost became embayed and therefore trapped when he was up in the north part of Alaska.
He didn't even land at Sitka, right? He just
observed it. No. His first landing was in Vancouver Island.
Mm-hmm.
And then his next landing was a little island called Kayak Island, which if you're flying between here and Seattle, you fly over every time. It's a little bit east of Prince William Sound and out in the ocean. Interestingly, his first landing and Bering's first landing, the Russian explorer who preceded Cook, were both opposite sides of the same tiny island out in the middle of the bay. It's essentially out from Mount St. Elias. And, of course, you know, when you fly, you see Mount St. Elias, so that's essentially where Kayak Island is.
So when he came into Prince William Sound, did he think he'd be able to get
Absolutely.
North from Prince
Absolutely.
William Sound?
Yes. He had... a couple of officers with him, Vancouver, who became famous in his own right later, and, of course, Captain Bly, who we've all heard of, famous for the mutiny, but also famous for Bly Reef and the Exxon Valdez grounding. Bly was with him, and Bly especially spent a lot of time in Prince William Sound looking for the imagined Northwest Passage. And when they didn't find it, they went up Valdez Arm. They did not go into western Prince William Sound. That was saved for later explorers. They then went into Cook Inlet. And
so he came straight out from Valdez, the port in Valdez, and
went
around to Cook Inlet subsequently.
Right, exactly. And so he came up Cook Inlet. He was pretty certain by the time they entered Cook Inlet that it wasn't going to be like Drake observed coming out on this vast ocean sea. He was pretty sure Cook Inlet was insular. They could taste the water. They saw logs rolling in the tides. They knew the tides were too high. But there were a number of officers who were so steeped in this lore of there being a passage that he actually had a lot of people insist that he go all the way up Cook Inlet.
So how far did he get? Did he get up above Knik Arm?
He went to Fire Island with his two ships. He was actually between Fire Island and what we now call Point Possession. Of course, it was called Point Possession because Captain Cook took possession for the crown
and
there.
And Turnagain.
Bligh went up Knik Arm in a small shoreboat. Didn't get very far. Then Cook had another fellow on the ship lead a small expedition up Turnagain Arm. They didn't get very far either because of the tides and the wind. And so Cook is the one who dubbed it Turnagain River, and it's in his journal, Turnagain River.
For that reason.
Because they turned around.
They couldn't make haste. Cook actually hated the place because it distracted him. He probably spent 2-3 weeks in Cook Inlet, and he knew when he started, at least he felt that he knew when he started, that Cook Inlet was going to be a dead end and that he really needed to find the Northwest Passage
was
somewhere else.
Was part of this intuitive, would you say? Because they really didn't have the scientific data to guide them, did they?
Right. Well, Cook was, of course, a brilliant navigator, and he had been a surveyor all of his life. He was famous for what he did in the French and Indian War, helped the British win that war because of his surveying capabilities. He had been on two earlier voyages of his own, one to Tahiti, Australia, New Zealand, a second one that basically circumnavigated the world at the South Pole, proving that Antarctica was just ice and not this giant continent, which everyone was expecting. So by the time he was on his third voyage, which is the one that brought him to Alaska, he was renowned. He was very accomplished as a navigator. And frankly, he got into many scrapes here in Alaska that have never really been featured in any of his other books.
Tell us about some of those scrapes.
Well, the one that I led in my book with, he was off the Aleutians, trying to find a way north after he'd left Cook Inlet. And it was a driving rainstorm, fog, wind, that sort of thing. And here he is in these two small boats. And remember, each one of these boats is about 100 feet long, 100 people aboard. I mean, these are cramped quarters, very small vessels.
A crew of 100 on each boat?
Oh, yes.
It was crowded.
Wow.
Was the scientist Banks with him on this third voyage?
No, Banks was on the first voyage.
Okay.
Banks attempted to go on the second voyage, and he had such a high view of his own competence that he tried to retrofit all of Cook's vessels to have this huge scientific complement, and Cook wouldn't have it.
Huh.
So Banks essentially was politely asked not to join the second voyage, and so there was no attempt to get him on the third voyage. But the scrape I was talking about near the Aleutians, so you here you are in these two tiny vessels, and they're in fog along the rocks of the Aleutian Islands, and several times they almost grounded and or crashed into adjacent rocks. And I tried to describe that as a part of the beginning, because essentially Cook, as this famous navigator, that's the reason they survived. Had they grounded, of course, here they are in the Aleutians, the furthest shore from Europe on the in the world, on the globe, and almost certainly they would have perished. But Cook was brilliant. He did this repeatedly, that is, get them out of scrapes. I mean, the whole story of this particular summer in Alaska was one of getting out of these close scrapes and meeting the native people along the way.
I'm really interested in that part, is contact with the indigenous people.
Yes.
Particularly since you say the Russians had not been in that part of Alaska yet.
Yes, yes. I think that's an important thing for residents of Anchorage and Cook Inlet to know, is that Cook was essentially the first European the Russians were still in Onalaska. They hadn't traveled east to Cook Inlet. They hadn't gotten to Kodiak Island yet. And so Cook was the first in this area and met the Dena'ina. And there's a picture that I've put in the book of the first drawing of what we think is a Dena'ina at Point Possession.
Do we have any records of Cook from native point of view? Are there native records about meeting
him? That's interesting.
Or just the records that he generated?
It's of course anecdotal, and historians have a hard time incorporating that into true history, I suppose, if that's what you want to call it. But I tried very hard to find out what we knew about those things, and Aaron Leggett, who's a Dena'ina historian here in Anchorage, helped me with understanding the contact at Point Possession when King on Cook's vessel took possession at Point Possession. There were, you know, he left some coins, and Aaron described to me what the traditions were about kids who dug up the coins and looked for Captain Cook and those kinds of remarks. The traditional recollections come out of Vancouver Island, and there they considered Cook just another trader, kind of like a native group down the street. In the South Pacific, Cook was exalted. The British were considered gods. Their ships were flying islands. It was a much different experience down there. And we all know about the yin and the yang, I suppose, of his relationship with the Hawaiians. But in Vancouver Island, he was just another trader. He had some neat stuff, nails particularly.
Yes.
And they were offering their stuff, he needed fresh supplies and water, so they traded.
He sold them nails, huh?
Oh, yes. Well, so yes. Yes. I mean, that's similar to the experiences all over the South Pacific, too. There they traded for other things. You know, the women liked to offer their favors to the sailors as well, and sometimes the captains complained that their ships were falling
exactly.
apart for all the nails getting pulled out of the walls. But
I love that.
Yeah, but in any event, that didn't really happen much in the North Pacific. The relationship was much more one of equals. The native people were obviously captivated by Cook, and the advantage we have about Captain Cook that's really not true of any other explorer of that era was he kept a pretty stunning record. They had an artist on board, John Weber, who drew profusely, and so we have views of the people of Vancouver Island, the people of Prince William Sound, the one view of the Dena'ina, and
they're included in the book, which
yes.
is very interesting.
Yeah, I think a word should be said for Flip Todd. Flip conceived this project, and Flip has done what I think is a magnificent job of putting virtually every original drawing and map that came out of the voyage into the book. And there are about 40 color views in this book, and you know, I've mentioned that there are hundreds of titles. There are very few titles about Captain Cook, even in the South Pacific, that do this well, providing the pictorial record. And so I really want to compliment Flip for investing in Captain Cook, as it were, in this part of the
world. And he did a wonderful job. The book is really wonderful. Did you always have a great interest in Captain Cook, or did Flip sort of ignite you to go further and on this odyssey?
Well, thank you for asking. Actually, I was born in California, and I guess I started this venture because I was so frustrated as a Californian reading in the history books as a child that our forebears were the Pilgrims in Massachusetts. Mm. Because as a Californian, of course, you know, you have all these Spanish names for every city, and California didn't even concentrate on its own history pre-Gold Rush. And so as a Californian, I was very interested in the early West Coast history, and when I moved to Alaska, of course, my interest expanded. So I'm very interested in essentially West Coast first contact up and down the coast from western Mexico to Alaska. And it's really a very fascinating story. We had contacts not just by Francis Drake, but also by a number of Spanish and French and, of course, Russian explorers. Even the Americans came in some areas. They weren't really in Alaska in any significance. The principal activity in Alaska was the Spanish. We had one important French voyage, La Perouse, the British, of course. But what was attracting them all here was fur And as we all know, the sea otter was virtually hunted to extinction, but the sea otter was impressive. Bering, who preceded Cook, brought some sea otter back, and so the people of Russia knew that the sea otter were here by about the mid-18th century, a couple of decades at least before Cook. But they just hopped from Aleutian Island to Aleutian Island. There was no formal investigation by the government. It was all just fur hunters trying to capture as many sea otters as they could. And each time they went to an island, they'd enslave the Aleut people, send the men out in their kayaks to hunt for sea otter. And when they brought the sea otter back, why, they released the families. That was the traditional way that the Russians hunted in the Aleutian Islands. And that Cook observed in Unalaska when he got to Unalaska. The British were not so draconian with the native people. The British traded instead, and that was the way that they collected their furs. But there were a number of British and good grief, even the Swedish and the Portuguese got to Vancouver Island to trade for sea otter furs until they were essentially hunted to extinction in the early 1800s.
Now, one of the things I've been curious about, Cook did drawings of Inuit people in Prince William Sound, and my understanding is that that's an unusual population for that part of Alaska, and that those people are not there at this time.
Well, no. The people that he encountered are, Inuit suggest Eskimo, and they called themselves Pacific Eskimo. They're the Aleutic from Kodiak, essentially, a different but similar population.
Oh, so they're not the same
they're
as the North Coast people.
They're not Greenland Eskimos at all, but they are related by Eskimos. And Cook and some of his crew had been to the East Coast, let's say the Canadian East Coast, and had encountered Inuit before. So what Cook was essentially doing is comparing these people to the Eskimos. Cook was a brilliant ethnographer for his time. You know, this is the Age of Enlightenment. Cook had essentially ascended from a farmer's son to be one of the most accomplished naval captains of his era, and he did so because he was a brilliant guy. So he had seen these Eskimos. Others had been on board, had seen American Indians. So they had an idea that how the Alaskans were related. John Ledyard, who's a famous American who was on the voyage, commented frequently about the relationship, particularly of the Dena'ina, who are Athabascan, to the Indians that he encountered.
So they saw the kinship relationship.
Right, there are kinship relationships, and they all noticed that. So while they were 200 years behind what we now consider to be accurate ethnology, why they still did a fine job of describing what they'd seen. Cook's journal is alive with the descriptions of the native people up and down this coast. I mean, it's something that he was very attracted to the native people of the Northwest Coast. He met the people on Vancouver Island, as I mentioned. He met some in Prince William Sound at Snug Corner Cove.
And it was a friendly relationship.
Absolutely, in all cases. He had positive and negative relations beforehand, and on the third voyage he was especially cantankerous about his relations with the native people because they were just prone to thievery. You know, when they couldn't get those nails by the good old-fashioned way, why, they'd just grab them. And they'd grab other things. And in fact, I trace his voyage to Hawaii principally because the story of Hawaii and the story of Cook are inseparable because, of course, he lost his life there. He arrived in Kealakekua Bay in early 1779. It was the only kind of protected anchorage. It's interesting. Cook traveled all of the Hawaiian Islands, and the only coastline of the Hawaiian Islands that he missed was the south side of Oahu, which had Pearl Harbor. So he thought Kealakekua Bay was the best anchorage in all of Hawaii. He went there. He was revered as a god, as I've described, but he returned after a foremast had broken on his ship. He was heading back to the north again for another year, testing the ice. He knew his ship could not last if he didn't fix it, so he went back to Kealakekua Bay. he'd essentially, they loved him so much, they gave him everything they had. And so when he returned, they were furious that he came back. And the relationship just was overnight, 180-degree difference from what had been encountered the first time.
And, because you said he almost had God status earlier times.
When he would walk on shore, the people would prostrate themselves behind him. Hmm. And he was a man who was not of his own free will. Everywhere he went, people followed him, and they would fall to the ground if he looked at them. And that was the experience he had in Hawaii. Well, he had none of that in Alaska. Again, the Alaskans treated him more or less as an equal, and he didn't mind that. And he wrote at length about it. In Unalaska, he wrote at length about the people of Unalaska. In fact, he almost stayed in Unalaska and did not travel to Hawaii that winter. But because the Russians had already occupied the area, he had no Russian speakers on board, so he had a poor relationship just speaking with the Russians.
They didn't share information, I guess, in those days.
Well, they did, and Cook left his map with the Russian factor there, and it ultimately found its way back to London. Mm. It's a fascinating document, which I've actually seen. It's at the Public Record Office in Kew near London. But Cook didn't ultimately decide to stay in Unalaska simply because the Russians were there. They had enslaved the native people. He just didn't want to get in the middle of that. And his crew, as you can imagine, wanted to go back to Hawaii and check it out. So that's what they did.
How did he communicate with the native people when he came to Alaska if he was the first contact?
Sign language.
Just sign language.
Sign language. In Vancouver Island and Alaska, it was fairly simple because trade was what British people did.
Mm-hmm.
And so they offer something and the other people would offer something. It was pretty clear what they needed was provisions and they were willing to offer nails. But you'll see in the records that particularly when he spent a period of time with the native people that he learned their language.
That is
rudimentary, but nonetheless, he was with the Nootka people for 4 weeks and had a fair description of their language in his journal, and the same for the people of Unalaska.
He just sounds like a fascinating man.
Yeah.
I've heard other aspects about him as well, that he had particular ideas about health and eating
yes.
on the high seas. None of his men ever died of scurvy, which was
yes, that's true.
Very common. What was some of his ideas?
The scurvy is a fascinating story, and we could talk about that for weeks at a time.
Uh-huh.
I mean, up until that time, especially the Spanish, just had horrendous experiences with these long voyages. They used to have Manila galleons that would go from the Philippines to the west coast of Mexico. And there were these huge lumbering craft that would carry the spices back to Spain, essentially, through Mexico. And all the crew would die or be dying when they got to Mexico from scurvy. Vizcaino, who essentially named all those places in California, those coastal names, he left with 200 men on two ships and returned with 30. All of them had died of scurvy. Cook didn't lose them to scurvy. And at the time, he had a series of things that he did. I mean, we've heard Brits called limeys today, and that's certainly what cured
the seamen out of the
citrus fruits. Well, he had some citrus fruits, but the way he solved it was through cleanliness. He gave them sauerkraut, but inadvertently also insisted on eating fresh provisions. For example, when he was in the Arctic, he had him eat walrus. Well, walrus tasted terrible, but he tried to convince his crew that they needed to eat this walrus. He didn't know it even, but eating the walrus, fresh provisions, there's vitamin C in that. So he had a series of dietary requirements, and inadvertently they saved his crew.
So he was just eating fresh food and running across the vitamin C where
yes.
he would.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And British yeah. are called limeys because of the limes they brought
because,
on ship with
yeah.
them?
Yeah, later they used to carry citrus fruits, limes principally.
Huh.
And so they would just suck on the limes, and that's what would keep scurvy down.
But obviously he was a progressive thinker and very opinionated if he decided something was correct.
Oh, by all means.
Yes,
yes indeed.
You know, I'd heard that his wife, he corresponded with her a great deal.
Yes.
But that she burned those letters. Is that true?
Well, you know, I don't know that she burned the letters. The story about his wife, Elizabeth, I mean, obviously, they had six children. And I'll bet you they didn't spend but 6 years together because he was mostly at sea. And, of course, he died at the third voyage, and they had six children by then. All the children predeceased Elizabeth. She died with all of her children already dead. Cook's three sons all went into the Navy, as you might imagine, and all died of various unusual circumstances. Another one died of a strange illness while at Cambridge University. And so, I mean, it's a really sad story. But the story I've heard about Elizabeth Cook is that after Cook died, she became essentially a widower. And even though she was fairly young, she never remarried because how do you compare these goofballs on the streets of London with James Cook?
And right.
So, I mean, he was
We have just a short time left here, Jim Barnett. Maybe you want to tell us something about your book and where it may be had for those who want to pursue it?
Well, thank you very much. I'd like to have everyone go out and get the book. I know Flipwood as well.
Definitely.
But it's not free.
Yeah, it's not free.
Oh, really? But really? It's a good book.
It's a good book, and it has a number of color pictures that I collected from all over the world. I mean, I've got everything in here that we in Alaska have, but that's not much. A lot of the pictures are from Australia, believe it or not. And the Aussies rever the guy, and so you go to Sydney to look at original Alaskan works, including the famous Snug Corner Cove picture that I feature in the book.
I suspect there's some surprises and things we don't know in this book.
Oh yeah,
too.
Oh I'm sure. I mean, Cook talked a lot about Anchorage and what he thought of Anchorage. He was discouraged about it, but he spoke positively about how there'd be probably some metropolis here someday. So I think that was very prophetic on his part. But the book, you can definitely get it at the museum bookshop. I know it's a Tidal Wave and all of the other favorite venues. And if it's not there, I'd be thrilled if you ask people.
I recommend that you ask people to find out more about Captain Cook in Alaska and the North Pacific. And if you're ready to run into Jim Barnett, you'll find out even more.
Absolutely. My favorite subject.
We want to thank you all again for spending this a half hour with us, and join us again next month for another episode of Alaska Radio Reader Rambler. Thank you, Jim Barnett.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandy. Thank you, Dick.